When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
At 10:30. But the audience outnumbers me. Surprise. This is always the worst time for any convention for a talk. I remember one situation which was even worse, though. It was an Irish convention in Dublin. As you can imagine, at 10 a.m. on a Sunday, not many people were awake and most of them had hangovers. I was one of six authors who were supposed to turn up for a panel. Only one other author made it to the panel, and after the panel, consisting of myself and James P. Hogan, a member of the audience came up to me and congratulated me for not punching him. So hopefully this panel won't be as bad. Panel? Well, it's just me. I could punch myself, but that might be counterproductive. My name is Charlie Stross, and as you can probably guess, I haven't had enough coffee yet this morning. I'm supposed to talk about myself for about an hour, but that's actually quite boring. So I think I should start by asking if any of you have any questions for me. And if you can come up with any questions, I will then extemporize from there. Do any of you have anything you want to ask me? Okay. Yep. I am not surprised.
Thank you for being so understanding.
Actually, it's not just the Italian translators who have a problem with my work. I have two novels which I'm informed probably can't be translated into Japanese at all. That's because they're Halting State and Rule 34. I don't think they've been translated into Italian either. They are Scottish crime novels set in the near future about crimes that don't exist yet due to new technology. And they're both told in the second person, as in, you walk into a room and you look around and you see the murder scene. Yep. Apparently the second person is incredibly rude in Japanese. You never talk to people in that mode of voice. Similarly, my novella Palimpsest would be a nightmare in German. It is a time police novella, won a Hugo in 2008, and, no, in 2010. The problem with Palimpsest is it makes extensive use of time paradoxes, and extensive use of English's weird ability to do conditional future tenses. You will have seen something or other. Apparently German just doesn't have the verb structure to do this. So, you know, again, that's a hard one to translate. So, yeah, I can kind of see why most of my stuff would be hard to translate. However, that's, I suspect, Accelerando and the other more technologically oriented fiction is a problem. For the past few years, actually, I've been mostly writing Laundry Files novels and alternating with a new trilogy set in the Merchant Princes universe called Empire Games. And these are sort of alternate present with a few extras, rather than being far future with lots of technological terminology. That's going to change because I was working on a space opera next year. It's been delayed for a bit, but will hopefully come out late. I was working on a space opera last year. I had to stop work when my father died and switch to other projects for a while. But hopefully that's going to come out in a year's time. And that's... The problem with writing near alternate present or near future work is it's so prone to being disrupted by the current turbulent waters of politics. So I decided to do a space opera set a quarter of a million years in the future because fuck that up, Mr. Trump. Yeah, my novel Empire Games that came out at the beginning of last year is set in an alternate 2020. Part of which has an America that's a dystopian surveillance state with police crawling out of the woodwork everywhere. It came out on January the 20th, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration. No, sorry, January the 19th, the day before Donald Trump's inauguration. And people were immediately reading it as a happy, fun, consolatory, better timeline. They had a police state, but hey, at least the people running it were competent. Anyway, the final word I should add on translation, by the way, is I know editors think it's their job to insulate everybody else in the book publishing business from authors, because let's face it, some authors are a bit weird, but I always get very, very worried when I know a book is being translated and I never receive any questions by email from the translator. I'm going to make this a blanket invitation. If any of you are ever asked to translate any of my work again, feel free to... Actually, you must contact me by email if you have any questions relating to the original text. I'd be more than happy to answer them, however stupid they sound or feel, because, you know, I want the best possible outcome. And now, any more questions?
A couple of things. Halting state is in Italian.
It is in Italian.
It is.
Good.
It is.
Yeah.
Now I know why on Palimpsest, why it came across to me as your most sophisticated piece of writing. That's your what you put it is your playing on tenses and these things. Well, so. Yeah. But then again, at that point, you said, and you said it in your blog as well, that we were thinking of expanding Palimpsest.
Yeah.
Is that ever going to happen? Have you ever thought of where it could go?
Yes, but it gets complicated. For those who haven't read it, Palimpsest is a novella. It won the 2010 Hugo for Best Novella. It was published in my short story collection, Wireless. And it's about the Stasi, a time patrol who have access... They have a monopoly on a single time machine, or rather a machine for opening gates between locations in space and time, which suppresses the operational capability of any other time machine within about a billion light years. There can only be one, and therefore one organization monopolizes it. And they have become very, very corrupt and very, very strange, over the many millions, indeed billions, of years that they control. And one of the things the Stasi have done is there is virtually no interplanetary or interstellar colonization, but they have modified the solar system so extensively that the Earth remains habitable for roughly 2 trillion years. That's 2,000 billion years. Fairly early on in it, one of the characters remarks that the thing about humanity is humanity always goes extinct relatively fast, within a quarter of a million years at most. So you just reset the biosphere and reseed with the Stone Ages, and a few thousand years later, they'll have invented civilization again. And you just keep doing this. Anyway, I wrote this in cold-blooded cynicism because I wanted to do a short story collection so I could take a sabbatical for a year without having to write a novel. And a short story collection needs some original content, so the existing fans who've read all the short stories will buy the collection. So I wrote this novella, and I picked The Time Police because I hadn't written a Time Patrol novella and hadn't even seen one for ages. Poole Anderson, Isaac Asimov, and so on aside. And I sent it to my agent because, unlike everything else in the collection, this one hadn't been published before. Is this good enough? I asked her. And she replied, yes, but you realize this is the first third of a novel. And she was sort of right. But then things hit the business of publishing. Now, as I mentioned, Palimpsest, the novella, describes the first couple of trillion years of the Earth. And it deals with some really, really, really huge questions. And I had very, very ambitious but vague plans for the next. It was going to be a three-act book with three novella-shaped sequences. The next one was going to stretch from 2 trillion years in the future, at the end of a stelliferous era in cosmology, through to around 10 to the 63 years in the future, around the end of a black hole era in cosmology, when the last remaining large black holes evaporate and we're left with endless night and darkness. And the third movement was going to be what happens after that. So, you know, not really a small scale here. But publishing contracts intervene. Because this is an original work that was first published in this short story collection, the publishers of a short story collection have a right to royalties from any future works based on it. And I was having great difficulty trying to get to grips with the rest of the novel. It's a hard one to work on. And then I parted company with my American publisher, Ace, part of Random Penguin, about 2-3 years ago. As a result, if I write the novel, I can either sell it to a publisher I don't really want to work with anymore, or if I sell it to another publisher, there'll be contractual encumbrances and that publisher will owe another publisher royalties, and it gets a bit hard. Having said that, Palimpsest is full of paradoxes, and one of the paradoxes towards the end is, we just get a glimpse of this, a sequence in which the time gate is used as a space gate. Instead of time travel, it is used for opening wormholes between star systems and colonizing a whole bunch of galaxies. Of course, the agency operating the Stargate would have a similar monopolistic behavior. And the space opera I'm currently working on, Ghost Engine, if you squint at it, it sort of collapses down into a single scene in Palimpsest, but it's actually an entire space opera setting in its own right. And it's set in a universe where there is a monopoly provider of wormholes for transit between star systems, and a quarter of a million years in the future, the entire local group of galaxies has been colonized, and humanity has speciated because we've had a quarter of a million years of CRISPR and gene editing, and every asshole dictator who wants a subject race has genetically engineered their own servants. And what happens to the servant races when their overlords become extinct? Things get complicated really fast. But that's not sort of finished yet. As I said, I was working on this novel when my father, who was 93 at the time, it wasn't premature, hit a terminal illness, went downhill in about 10 weeks and died. And nothing puts you off editing a novel like having a parent on their deathbed. So I put that on the shelf. And because I'd put in nearly a year's work on it, that put me very much behind schedule. So at last year's Worldcon in August, well, what I decided to do was leave it for a year and go back to it. And I will go back to it and publish it in due course. But at last year's Worldcon, I met with my American and British editors and basically told them, well, my dad just died, couldn't finish the novel. Can I write you something else? How about the next laundry novel that I've got planned? And that's why my next book is going to be 3 months late. It's because I didn't begin writing it until after the original deadline had passed. And that novel, how many people here are familiar with The Laundry Files?
Yeah.
Oh, one or two. Okay, only one or two? It's the 9th Laundry Files book. It's... okay, it is set 6 months after things have gone very, very wrong and an elder god has moved into Downing Street. Britain is ruled by Lovecraftian horrors. The United States is even worse.
Who is worse than Lovecraftian horrors?
Well, Lovecraft, as I think I said in Echoid, when Bob meets a unicorn and wishes he hadn't, Lovecraft was sort of a very unreliable guide to cosmology and alien elder gods. Lovecraft was sort of like the author of the Anarchist's Cookbook, where if you follow most of the recipes for bombs, you'll blow your own hands off. Do not rely on Lovecraft. You know, he got some of the names right, like Cthulhu, but his description of Cthulhu owes far too much to his own phobias of seafood and female genitals. The true Cthulhu is much, much worse and different. Think parasitoid wasps.
Okay.
The kind that lay their larvae inside you and eat you from the inside out.
And how does the... talking about you're about to write. Let's follow this thread about what you're about to write or what you're writing. Now, the space opera, the far future, how is it connected somehow? Thematically or
okay.
Whatever.
The space opera is not connected to Palimpsest other than sharing a central conceit that could overlap with it at some future point. What happened was I realized I had written 8 sequels or series books in a row, almost all of which were set in the present or the near future, and I was getting sick of it. Also, the previous 2 novels I had written had run into Brexit and Donald Trump, respectively, and I wanted to run away screaming from the present day. So it seemed like a good idea to write a space opera. This is going back about 18 months. And I deeply, deeply miss Ian Banks, both as somebody to go drinking with in a pub and as an author of some of the finest space opera in British science fiction. I do not want to write a culture novel. There have been some rumours that there might be a tribute anthology to Ian organised by his literary executors at some point, although they are probably not going to do that until at least 5 years after his death, out of respect. And I might write a short story for that, but I don't want to clone the culture. There can only be one Ian M. Banks. But I'm missing something that has that particular feel for the huge scale of his future. Ian's work was unique compared to most space opera in that it was not anything remotely related to the Star Wars or Star Trek franchises in feel or tone. It wasn't classic space opera, but it challenged the general view of the future of an authoritarian or monarchical or totalitarian dominated empire. The culture, his space-going centerpiece, has been loosely parodied as luxury gay space communism with hippies. It's a utopian vision in which, as one of his protagonists puts it, money is a symptom of poverty. It's somewhere everybody would like to live, except for libertarians, who find it kind of slightly frightening for some interesting reason. American libertarians don't like it. Everybody else does. And it seemed to me that most space operas sort of unthinkingly accept a whole bunch of our current day assumptions about money, about economics, about governance, about determinism and human biology. And it occurs to me, if we've already got to the point where we're talking about genetic engineering of human beings today, what's it going to be like in a quarter of a million years' time? In the future of Ghost Engine, our species is extinct. Our existence is inferred by those who think about such things as the last common hominid ancestor. There are many, many human species, although they're not exactly like us. I deliberately used the words elves and dwarves quite late in the book, after having established these by character. But we have the tall, thin hominids and the fairly short, squat ones. Different species engineered by different... Well, also, what sort of person goes around and deliberately engineers a human subspecies for distinctive characteristics? The answer is somebody not very nice, somebody who wants slaves or servants. This happens repeatedly in human history, and slave-owning societies don't generally last indefinitely. They tend to die off eventually. The descendants of the slaves live on. What is it going to look like so far in the future that they have forgotten their origins, they have become autonomous peoples, the slave owners themselves have been exterminated, and so on. Now, I had an interesting setting. I also mentioned a single organization, call it the Authority, who can open wormholes between star systems. They can only open a finite number. They cannot have more than two wormhole endpoints open at any simultaneous time anywhere in the cosmos. Therefore, this puts an upper limit on the number of interstellar wormholes that can exist at any given time. Therefore, we have a vast economic system based on scarcity, because economics is the study of resource allocation when scarcity exists, dedicated to controlling space travel. Well, interstellar space travel in reasonable times. And when you have such a central authority, there are certain consequences. One is they're going to be very secretive about where they're based. If everybody knew where they lived, then sooner or later some very, very aggressive person with a battle fleet will turn up, slovenly, and conquer them and take over the monopoly. And the reason is that because they have a monopoly, some emergent properties exist. A universal time and distance and coordinate framework for saying where you want your wormholes to go. A universal trade language for purchasing stuff in. A universally acceptable currency. It may not be the currency everybody uses locally, but it's what you have to use to buy or sell interstellar transit passes. And a few other things. Basically, if you want to run a transport system, you need a time framework, you need a coordinate framework, you need money, and you need a language to communicate with people in. These are actually really useful if you're going to write a space opera. Everybody needs to be able to plug into it. You have some sort of global culture. This is just one aspect of it. Another, we all have social media presences today. We're gradually growing used to computers becoming more and more ubiquitous. You may have noticed, if you've stayed in this hotel, every single door handle has a computer inside it. It's how you get in and out of your room. We're heading towards a point where every radiator, every light switch, every light bulb has a computer in it. This is today. How far can this go? Well, I've done some research and planning on ubiquitous computing, and it's going to hit the point where pretty much every single square meter of pavement outside in every town is going to have its own monitoring networked computer, where street lights will not be illuminating the entire street at random. They'll be projecting a beam of photons of the area that they can see that your eyes are pointed at. for every individual on the street, rather than wasting photons lighting up stuff that nobody's looking at. Everything you do, everything you say, will be monitored and recorded by your ghost in the cloud, as it were, which will be following you around. And, well, what happens if you die on another star system? Well, obviously your data ghost will need to migrate home to the shrine, to your family's ancestor shrine, where the ghosts of all your ancestors are recorded, and it will do this fast store and forward through drop boxes carried on starships. Starships are psychopomps. They ferry the ghosts of the dead home. It gets weirder and weirder the further down the rabbit hole you go. One of the problems with this, you may be familiar with transhumanism and the particular species of singularity worshippers who believe we are all going to be uploaded and our minds are going to go and live inside the cloud. This is actually a rather peculiar Russian Orthodox Christian heresy based off the works of the 19th century theologian Nikolai Fyodorovich Fedorov. Without going into too much detail on Fedorov's beliefs, Fedorov was trying to work on a teleological theology and work out what God's plan for humanity was. And his view was, obviously, humanity needs to become perfect to join God. Part of this perfection involves, well, obviously, immortality, omniscience, total peace, unification behind a common cause. And Fedorov concluded that the only common cause that every human being can agree on is that the enemy is death. You need to abolish death and colonize the entire cosmos. This was a Russian Orthodox clergyman in the 19th century proposing interstellar colonization, I should add. And he then took it one step further. Fedorov's view was it is an insult to every immortal living throughout the future cosmos if their ancestors remain dead. We must seek to resurrect not only everybody who has lived and died, but everybody who might have lived. We're getting into the singularitarian stuff here, aren't we? Indeed, the modern singularity worshippers among the transhumanists have reinvented Christianity, and a particular form of Christianity at that. It's an interesting design pattern for a religion. And it occurs to me that in this future, we don't have an actual AI singularity as such. Although we have various godlike minds wandering around, they're usually what's left over after a human being who's bolted too many computers to their brain dies and the computers carry on going. They're a bit weird and dangerous. But an awful lot of species who have been engineered to worship a ruler, because that's what quite a lot of dictators do, have been engineered for excessive susceptibility to religious beliefs. Because, of course, if you're engineering slaves to work for you, you want them to worship you. You don't want to be at risk of a slave rebellion, and the best way to immunize yourself against a rebellion is if they think you're a god. So after the gods die, the former slaves assert independence and go elsewhere, but they keep succumbing to religious zeal and new religions. And Fedorovism, as it's called, is pretty much the commonest design for a religion out there. It's not Christianity, it is just warmed over singularitarianism. And the problem with this belief that we're all going to be uploaded and go to live in AI heaven is that it begs the question of who is going to administer and run heaven, and in accordance with what agenda. There's scope for an awful lot of holy wars in there, an awful lot of reformations. And so it's sort of a far future space opera where the whole singularitarian thing has gone horribly, horribly wrong and resulted in crusades and jihads every few thousand years. And our viewpoint protagonists are from sort of outside this. As I said, I wanted to write a book, but I was nostalgic for Ian Banks, so I decided to write an Ian Banks novel that wasn't an Ian Banks novel. One that would sort of satisfy the same craving that Ian satisfied without being obviously derivative. And a starting point for this, and this is where I got too clever for my own boots, is that Ian was a literary writer. He wrote literary fiction as well as science fiction. It's just a marketing distinction. So I decided to play literary games in this novel. And The obvious way to do it was to write a literary novel disguised as a space opera, or vice versa. You may have heard of The Great American Novel as something that American academics obsess over. Philip Roth, John Updike, Don DeLillo took the piss out of it. There's a standard great American literary novel of the 20th century. You have a middle-aged English professor teaching at a university at the height of his prestige and power, but all is not well in his personal life. His marriage is failing. His wife is icy and distant. This might or might not be something to do with the affair he's having with a blonde postgraduate student. And, of course, he is unaware of a blonde postgraduate student in turn having an affair with a young, dynamic, upwardly mobile professor who is going to dethrone him, and something horrible is happening that will come out of his childhood trauma and past to kill him or disrupt his life. Well, apparently everybody on every creative writing master's degree course has to write this book at some stage, if they're male and white. Non-white males get a pass and don't have to do this thing. I decided if you're going to write a space opera that's an homage to Ian Banks, it has to be a homage to a particular type of literary fiction, and I was going to take the piss out of The Great American Novel. It starts out as this sort of love triangle, except these are not entirely human beings, and by the time we get partway in, we realize it's going off the rocks. At the point where the professorial male is abducted by psychopathic space ninjas, the wife and girlfriend realize they're pregnant and they have to get him back to incubate the egg. So our male professor is the one who ends up barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen. Where I went wrong was I got too ambitious with doing a really, really, really complex structure and got it wrong in the first draft and was midway through redrafting it when my father became ill and I had to stop. I'm going to get back to it and redraft it, and hopefully Ghost Engine will be published sometime in 2020. Maybe as early as 2019. But that's the only space opera currently. Otherwise, as I said, I'm working on the Empire Games trilogy, which I don't think The Merchant Princes have been translated into Italian. Okay. That's a whole 9-book series about time travelers between parallel universes and economics, in particular development traps. If you're unfamiliar with it, I won't go into it at this point, except to say I'm currently rewriting book 9 in an ongoing series that starts off looking like classic portal fantasy, and by the end of book 9 will have turned the corner into space opera. I'm going for genre shifts here. I'm also working on more of The Laundry Files, which is really the story of the Lovecraftian singularity. A different kind of revelatory horror.
Tell you the Merchant Princes will go on in groups of three?
No. The first series was originally going to be 4 gigantic, big, fat doorsteps, which would be sort of sold as techno-thriller. But my editor at Tor, David Hartwell, thought, one, I'm going to chop these books in half so I can publish twice as many books and make more money. So, and then, 2, put high fantasy covers on them, because he was afraid of being sued by my SF publisher, Ace. The upshot is the first series came out as 6 slim fantasy-looking novels. I then did a rewrite for the launch in the UK, and redid them as the original big, fat, thrillerish books. And these are the omnibus editions you may see in the UK or the US now, starting with the Bloodline feud. And after this, I was exhausted for a couple of years, but I signed up to do another trilogy. But there's now nearly 1 million words of this stuff, and I'm tired. If I go back to that universe, it will be for standalone novels, set increasingly far into the future. The first series was set between the years 2001 and 2003. The new trilogy is set in 2020. Anything else is going to be set no earlier than 2040 and further out. In a cosmology where there are many parallel universes, most versions of Earth are uninhabited, but there are scary relics of super high technology civilizations throughout Paratime, and human beings from a couple of technologically advanced timelines are exploring these. One of which is sort of descended from our own. If you imagine a version of our timeline in which George W. Bush was assassinated in the White House in 2003 using a nuclear weapon stolen from the US inventory by extra-dimensional narco-terrorists, which then resulted in an inter-timeline nuclear war. I could describe this series at length because there's an awful lot of it and bore you all to tears. All I should say for now is if you think you'd like it, you might want to look for The Bloodline Feud, which is the very first book in the first series. Or if you want to start with the more recent stuff, Empire Games, which is the first in the new trilogy.
Okay, first of all, we may... Yeah.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'm halfway through the Living Brief, so I've read all the other novels.
Okay.
I know the. And who's the main character in Labyrinth Index?
The main character in the Labyrinth Index is Mari, who is suffering from severe imposter syndrome. 6 months into the new management, where the British government has been replaced by the government of the Mandate. Nyarlathotep, Hotep, the Black Pharaoh, has moved into number 10 Downing Street. He is intent on taking Great Britain out of the European Union without a referendum, for this is 2015, because he needs to remove the European Convention on Human Rights from British law and bring back the death penalty. Why? Asks Mari over tea and crumpets at number 10 Downing Street. There haven't been enough human sacrifices lately. But what else? Oh, why are you getting us out of the EU? Oh, I also want to end free movement. Why do you want to end free movement? To stop the sacrifices escaping. Brexit makes perfect sense if you imagine that the UK is ruled by a Lovecraftian elder god. Mari is 38 years old and is suffering from imposter syndrome because until a few years ago she was basically a senior executive assistant in a bank. And she is now Baroness Karnstein, a member of the House of Lords, a life peer, this weird British system for appointing members of the upper house by calling them a member of a nobility, and chair of the House of Lords Permanent Committee on Sanguinary Affairs. She's the government's chief vampire.
You had another one?
Yeah.
And I should add, this is the good guy. We're talking about a vampire with an MBA from Human Resources who works for an elder god.
Another question.
Uh-huh.
About McMaster.
Yeah.
You had a wide choice of airlines to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
Why take down an Alitalia flight? We had a lot of financial problems, you know?
I was looking at the time of day, but that was very, very carefully timed. I was checking on Google Earth and against likely travel time from Malham Cove, where Yorkshire is invaded by an elven army. The host of Air and Darkness arrives at a particular location and advances on Leeds on horseback across country. How fast do they move? Where will they be by the time at which the morning airline flights from Europe to the United States are going? And which airlines are going to be flying a great circle route that takes them directly over Yorkshire? The German airlines from Frankfurt typically go over Scotland. The French and Dutch airlines typically go over the English Channel and just south of Ireland. It's Italy from Rome where they're flying over Yorkshire and get hit by a strategic air defense basilisk. Because, of course, any sufficiently advanced magic is indistinguishable from technology, and the elven host practiced combined arms warfare straight out of the Soviet Red Army's doctrine. There is, at one point, a totally Tom Clancy dogfight between Dragon Riders and Eurofighter Typhoons, neither of which are prepared for their countermeasures. Yeah, the Typhoons carry air-to-air heat-seeking missiles. Modern heat-seeking missiles aren't simple thermal images that lock onto the hottest thing around, or they lock onto flares. They're actually infrared cameras with fairly sophisticated image recognition pattern-matching computers behind them that identify the right part of an enemy airframe to explode next to. Dragons don't really look like anything in their database. Meanwhile, the Dragon Riders mostly have magical or cognitive countermeasures designed to cause the heads of the opposing dragons to explode. They're not really equipped for countermeasures against unthinking lumps of metal. So it doesn't end well for either aircraft.
Will you ever write a novel without mega, giga, tera quantities of humor in it?
Probably not. The Merchant Princess has much less humor than the other stuff, but it's still sort of a little bit snarky about things. Tucked away in the most recent one of them, Dark State, there is a comment to the effect that the 21st century is an absolutely terrible era to be paranoid schizophrenic in, after a lengthy discussion of all the ways the government is bugging everybody. Humor is, to some extent, my shtick. Thanks.
Someone else?
We've got about five minutes. Yep. Yeah.
And the Thanos I was wondering, would we still see the moon without the sun? Is the starlight enough?
I'm not sure. I didn't think it through that thoroughly.
You're from Leeds, right?
Originally, yes. That's why I destroyed it in the Nightmare Stacks.
That was the question. Why? When
I was pitching the novel at my editor, I said, oh, and by the way, I'm going to destroy Leeds. Oh, Leeds? Why Leeds? Well, it's where I come from. But Charlie, this is your 16th novel. Authors normally destroy their hometown in their first novel. Yeah. Why have you waited so long? Delayed gratification.
But then, some time ago in a blog post, you started a self-destruction of Europe and the world from Italy, from the volcano eruption near Naples.
Hang on, which novel? In which?
In a blog post.
Did I? Oh, hang on. The supervolcano. There's a huge supervolcano near Italy. And everybody seems to speculate about the eruption of the Yellowstone supervolcano in America, which would depopulate North America. But there are similar ones elsewhere. There's one in Indonesia, and there's one right in the middle of Europe. Not far from here. I'm trying to remember precise details. He's asked about a blog post from some years ago, and I can't remember the specific one.
That was the scenario there. Naples, part of Naples, is built on. And that's where that scenario started from. That's what I remember.
Okay, but I don't remember.
Okay, yeah. Sorry about that. We never directly spoke about the older novels, the ones that got translated originally. The first to be translated in Italian, the singularity, all the singularity stuff.
Yes.
Well, how do you see them now, retrospectively?
There were internal inconsistencies in the world building of Singularity Sky that meant I couldn't continue in that universe. Now, when I first sold those novels in the United States, my agent negotiated a deal with Ace for Singularity Sky and a sequel. If I'd known then what I know now, I would have argued the case and made Iron Sunrise a standalone novel, not a sequel. Because if I'd done that, with only some minor changes, I could have written many sequels to Iron Sunrise, as long as I could chop off and ignore Singularity Sky. But they're an explicit, sequels. They share characters, and the background to the world in Singularity Sky has some internal paradoxes, because I was dealing with time travel, and I got it wrong. And these would come to light if I did any further books in that universe. In particular, Palimpsest was doing the time travel thing right, getting the paradoxes right. So that I will not be writing any more books in that universe. To some extent, Ghost Engine is my attempt at generating myself a new space opera universe I can write sequels in. I did that a little bit earlier with Saturn's Children and Neptune's Brood, but that's a very, very difficult universe to work in, because humanity is extinct. The people in it are humanoid robots that, who think like human beings, but it's difficult writing when your protagonists aren't actually human. And as a final aside on that one, as I said, I changed publishers in America recently. It's hard to keep an ongoing series going when you move publisher. Now, Tor wanted the Laundry Files, which is why that's moved. But the other stuff would be a harder sell. In particular, it is normal for the sales of any successive book in a series to fall from book to book. Series usually go downhill by between 10 and 50% for each successive book. This is why you'll see so many first two books in a trilogy that's never completed on the shelves. It's because book two sales tanked. Luckily for me, the Merchant Princes books, sales remained steady. It didn't increase a lot, but they didn't decline, which means I'm actually winning. I'm swimming against the tide. And in the Laundry Files, the sales are actually rising by 15% with each successive book. It's actually a success, which again is pretty rare. But in the UK, Neptune's Brood sales were down relative to Saturn's Children. In the US, I had just changed publisher. There was not really any scope to take that series to another publisher. And indeed, I couldn't think of anything I absolutely had to say in that universe that I couldn't do better by just starting a clean sheet.
Okay, sad to say, time is running out. If we have a very, very short question, or you can...
Thank you.
You have 3 seconds to wrap it up. 2-0.
Oh.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Just as I was about to go on a lengthy explanation of my next novel project that I haven't begun yet.
Write it down and put it on the book.
Not going to do that because I need to write it instead. But
maybe
something's
better.
The third Scottish police procedural. The one that's been delayed because of the Scottish political singularity. I'll finally be able to write it once I know what kind of Brexit is going to be inflicted on us. So, next
Let's
year.
See. Yeah. Ok, thank you. Grazie, ciao Stross.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificas.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. L'autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Arme rosse, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
75%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 posizionato.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% Lean Ground Sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.